Hello and welcome to the official relaunch of Endeavors. A few things happened, as you can tell, probably over the summer. I was away teaching, and just a lot of technical issues led me to relaunch and rebrand. So I'm no longer found at Pods with Benefits. I'm now at EndeavorsMedia.com, and you should check it out. So ordinarily, I'd be releasing one show a week. However, I have such a backlog of material, 6 or 7 episodes worth, in fact, that I'm going to be releasing two to three a week here in the next little while to get caught up with myself. So, as usual, it'll be the standard three guests a show. One musical guest and then 2 other featured guests. And so we have a really good show here for you on the first episode of our relaunch. We have author Craig Davidson, who you might know better as horror writer Nick Cutter, but he's writing under his real name right now, and he has released a memoir entitled Precious Cargo about his time driving a city school bus. We also have on pinball machine collector, aficionado, expert, Kyle Suller. Kyle is a very interesting fellow, and he's involved with a company where they place pinball machines in various stores around the city here in Vancouver. So I'm going to talk to him about that and why the pinball machine is still such a popular form of entertainment after all these years. And I'm super happy that our musical feature this week is Pentatonix. I got to speak with one of the quintet, Mitch Grassi, about their self-titled new album and their transition to writing and recording original music. So that's all coming up today on Endeavors. Love me now while we're alive. It's the best thing we can do. Or we'll have no time upon cloud nine. Heaven on earth will have to do. I can sing like a bird and dance like a demon, and I do it all so well. Cause I made a deal with the devil, and when I die, I'm going straight to hell. Oh yeah, I'm going straight to hell. My first guest is an author whose 2013 novel Cataract City was named as a shortlisted nominee for the 2013 Scotiabank Giller Prize. His first short story collection, Rust and Bone, which was published in 2005, was adapted into a movie in 2012, by a French director, Jacques Audiard. He has also written under the names Nick Cutter, which he uses for horror literature, including novels The Troop and The Deep, as well as Patrick Lestuka, whose novels include Mother Bitch Fight, The Preserve, and The Colosseum. He is Craig Davidson, and his new memoir is Precious Cargo, and I spoke to Craig earlier this summer.
You've got a memoir out called Precious Cargo. With all the books you've written, the literary fiction, the horror, why was now the right time for you to write a memoir?
Oh, I'm not sure if it was the right time so much. This is just kind of where it fell. The actual experience was back in 2008, 2009, and I think some experiences you have in your life, you need to, kind of take some time, wrap your head around it, make sure that you're approaching it in the right and respectful way. So it just felt like I needed that time to get some distance from it and also be able to comment on it in the way that I wanted to. And that's kind of how it rolled out now in 2016.
It only happened, seven, 8 years ago, but do you look at it differently now than you did at the time?
I think probably like a lot of people, when you're in the heat of any kind of experience, you're having the first wave of emotions as to how this experience is affecting you. In this case, I drove a bus for children at the time, adults now with special needs. And when you're dealing with something that is such you know, carries such an emotional quotient to it. I think at the time you're just reacting in some ways. And after you give yourself a couple of years to reflect on it, and you come to sort of a deeper understanding of what the experience meant to you, and you can maybe comment on it in a little bit more reflective way.
That's a very interesting experience, because a lot of people work as bus drivers, but even less, you know, deal exclusively with children with special needs. Just talk about that specific type of children and the impact that you think that they had on you later in your career.
Yeah, I think I came into the experience really kind of as an ignoramus, to be honest, Dan, like in that I didn't have any experience with children or adults really with special needs, not on an on-the-ground level, and not even really in an experiential way with, say, somebody in my family, immediate or even, you know, sort of in-laws who had something that would be seen as specifically as a special need. So, I mean, I think the first part of it is grappling with was I the right type of person to do this? Was this an opportunity or an experience that I felt that it was a good thing to go through with? Because I clearly, as a bus driver, I could have driven, a bus full of, say, 50 kids, had your normal, like, big bus experience. But ultimately, I had this opportunity, and I decided to go with it, and think that if I'm not the right type of person, then I would bow out gracefully. But as it turned out, it was one of these kind of galvanic and really life-changing events that I don't think anyone's sure or can say conclusively, oh, this is going to be a life-changing event. It just kind of happened. And that's, I suppose, why I was compelled so much to write about it.
I think there's a perception that, you know, a bus driver, whether it's a city bus driver or a school bus driver or even something like the Greyhound, that they live a bit of a lonely existence. I think just because of the nature of their job. But how misaccurate is that? Like, sort of the day and day life of a bus driver, how would you describe that?
Well, I think there probably are a lot of, like, lonely bus drivers. You know, one thing that I worried about, I'm the sort of person who likes to have new experiences, new kind of adventures, and the idea of, like, driving the same route every single day struck me as, like, soul-deadening at some level. You know, the same way as a subway driver, you're just, like, ferrying this big metal worm through tubes underneath the city, and I thought, oh, God, who would... You know, that's a living death. Who would want that? I was kind of thinking, I was at the time like 30 years old. I thought, I'm way too young to be a bus driver. My preconception of, you know, who a bus driver was a lot different from what it actually was. I mean, I worked with a lot of, like, younger bus drivers, single moms and single dads and, you know, people pursuing their PhDs. It's actually a perfect job for someone who, you know, has what is a full-time job, but really allows them a lot of time in the, you know, in the late morning and afternoon to get their other stuff done. So, you know, but primarily I was worried about the boredom, and it could have been boring in a different situation, but I ended up making such close friends with these kids on the bus, that our days were, you know, full of, like, joy and laughter and, you know, humor.
And talk about the kids as well, because that's another area that interests me. Again, I think there's this, perhaps, a lot of misinformation about those with special needs. I mean, we're hearing a lot more about it now with the whole conversation about autism and stuff like that. But I still think there's definitely a stigma to not only the kids who have special needs, but parents of kids who have special needs. Talk a little bit about that. How much did working and being around those children change your opinion of who they are?
Yeah, I mean, enormously, because I think I came into it with the same preconceptions that a lot of people would, those being something along the lines of how are the encounters going to be day to day with, say, you know, a boy or girl who has cerebral palsy or Fragile X syndrome or autism or Asperger's or some of these, say, global delays that don't necessarily have, you know, they don't have a medical kind of term for it, but are just sort of, you know, present. So, you know, and I thought, well, you know, these encounters are going to be so different or heart-wrenching or, you know, painful in certain ways that would I even want to approach it? And what you find out is, like many things in life, is that your fears are, they're not unfounded, but they're not really, they're not nearly as founded as you think they are. You know, the encounters that I had with these kids, the back and forth I had with these kids were, and I've done a lot of, like, I've worked at a library with kids, and I've worked as a teacher. So, you know, in many, many ways, in the most profound ways, those experiences were echoed in the experiences I had with the kids in the bus. We laughed, we told stories, they shared their unique outlook on the world with me, and I, you know, helped them, you know, in terms of, like, you know, I wasn't their teacher. I was just like, let's sit, let's talk. I'm interested in the things that you have to say. I find you guys hilarious and fun and wise. And so, you know, I don't want to say the easy thing would be like they're just kids like any other kids. But the truth is, there are differences. But just because there are differences is not anything that should be, that someone necessarily needs to worry themselves about. And that if you have an experience or you go into it, with a child with a special need, you're probably going to find 99-100% of the time almost that your fears were not founded.
I'm curious as to whether, you know, the kids that you've worked with, and you've even said in the past you've worked as a, you know, as a librarian, you've worked as mm-hmm. a teacher, how experiences like those would manifest themselves in a novel or sort of any creative undertaking that you do?
You mean going forward?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I find, you know, I think most novelists are kind of like magpies in that we find elements of our life that were really resonant to us or affected us in a certain way. And because the emotions that were conjured from those experiences, those encounters were so profound and strong, you want to share them with the reader. And, of course, you aren't necessarily going to do it in the exact way that it happened in your life. I mean, this, again, this is my first memoir. It's my, you know, 9th or 10th book, so it's been a while. You know, I've never actually approached my own life in a direct fashion. But, I mean, going forward, yeah, I mean, my next book is a collection of short stories, and there is, no one would be surprised to hear, a story about a bus driver. So a fictionalized account, but clearly drawing on my own experience in life.
Was it harder to write about your own life and about a personal experience rather than a fictional tale that was all in your head?
That's a good question, Dan. I think it wasn't harder for me to, like, I've always been a pretty confessional, I mean, I used to, you know, write a blog back when those things were a thing, you know, and so I never had a problem sharing my own concerns, outlooks, worries, failings with anybody who might potentially be reading. But I think in this case, you know, I am dealing with, these aren't characters, you know, these are people, these are children, now adults, and they have families, and they have rights, you know. And that's different, because you can do anything as a novelist to some fictional character. You can put them through any number of enormous trials, and you don't feel badly, you sleep fine at night, because you know they don't exist. This, I carried a huge burden of responsibility and concern, which really is what maybe another reason why it took so long to actually finally write it down, because you're grappling the whole time with the recognition that these kids and their families have rights.
Have you, you know, you mentioned that they're adults now. Have you kept in touch or followed up with any of the kids that used to drive?
Yeah, it's it is a tough thing, because we were, they were between the ages of 13 and 18, and I was 31, 32, so I was already twice their age, and it was okay, we were hanging out because we're on the bus and that was my job, but I sort of thought, what if I showed up at one of their houses, you know, in the summer and just like, hey, you want to go throw the baseball around? And their parents would have been like, aren't you their bus driver? That's a little weird, dude. So, you know, it was kind of like we've kept in touch through Facebook, and one of the children, now an adult, Jake, who was a writer and still is interested in being a writer, and we hung out off the bus a lot. I mean, a great deal of the novel was written based on Jake and I's relationship. And so we stay in touch you know, keep in contact. But some of the other kids, I don't see them. You know, I sort of keep up of their events of their lives through Facebook, those of whom are on it. But it's one of these events like, you know, I went to summer camp when I was a kid, or I did tree planting when I was a little older. And you have these really strong experiences with people. And then when it's done, you scatter to the four winds, but you carry the memories of that experience with you.
You know, so much in the world has changed and evolved in the, you know, in the 7 or 8, 9 years that this experience took place, just technologically, socially.
Mm-hmm.
Like, looking back on that time, are you amazed at sort of how far or how little we've advanced since then? Just like looking at it from a writer's perspective.
Do you mean in terms of our societal?
Yeah, like I mean, you know,
and adults with special needs.
Yeah, well, like, you know, we've had a lot of social progress, and we've had a lot of, you know, good conversations about issues and mental delays. But we've mm-hmm. also gone back a lot, of, you know, in other ways too.
Yeah, I feel like that's a valid question, and I tend to agree. I think we have made enormous progress. You know, like when I was first researching the book, I looked at the way we treated adults with cognitive delays at, you know, in the 1800s and in the 1900s, and, you know, I mean, the freak show, the idea of a freak show, which was still going up until probably the 1970s, even the 1980s, was, you know, this was really people laughing and jeering at people who had, you know, severe, you know, delays or, you know, kind of physical imperfections. So we've come an enormously long way, but I mean, there's still work to do, obviously.
What is the one thing you want your readers to take away from this book?
Well, I think most honestly, Dan, I want them to see it as like, I want them to hopefully experience the fun and the joy that I had on that bus. I mean, I think the parts that people will probably like most about this book are the ones where I've like just faithfully transcribed the conversations that I had with these kids, and they will just, I think, be rolling with laughter in some cases. They will find it very touching and profound at other times. So really, if I've done my job, I've let these kids speak for themselves.
The book is Precious Cargo, My Year Driving the Kids on School Bus 3077. Craig Davidson, thanks so much for your time today.
Dan, I appreciate it.
Alrighty, have a good one. Ciao.
Alright, take care.
That was Craig Davidson, author of the new memoir, Precious Cargo. We're now going to hear a song from Pentatonix off of their new album, which is self-titled. This is their song, Take Me Home.
You light up in the dark. You're the glow in a priceless work of art. Oh, I see your shining star. You're the light through my window from afar. Oh, and don't you forget, the only thing that matters is your heartbeat going strong. Oh, don't you forget that nothing else can matter, 'cause you know where I belong. Oh, take me there. Won't you take me there? Won't you take me home? Oh, take me there. Won't you take me there? Won't you take me home? We light up the sky. Ooh. Heaven knows there's no such thing as goodbye. Oh, love can never die.
We'll
forever. you forget. The only thing that matters is our heartbeats going strong. Oh, don't you forget that nothing else can matter, 'cause we know where I belong. Oh, take me there, won't you take me there, won't you take me home. Oh, take me there, won't you take me there, won't you take me home.
And that was Pentatonix with their song, Take Me Home. And I'm now really privileged to bring you my chat with Pentatonix member Mitch Grassi. Mitch is one-fifth of the Grammy Award-winning quintet. And he talks about the band's journey from doing cover songs to recording a full album of original material, which they all wrote themselves. And yes, he talks about their appearance in Pitch Perfect 2. So here is my conversation with Mitch Grassi.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going great. So you guys have a new album out, and this is your first album of original music rather than covers. How did it come about for you guys to decide, okay, we're ready to dive in and record original music for the first time?
Yeah, well, I think we had pretty much covered all the bases when it came to cover songs, and I feel like we had garnered a pretty good fan base from doing that, and I think we just honestly wanted to progress as a band and a musical entity, and I think just take it to the next level, and really, honestly, just be actual competitors in the pop realm. And to do that, you have to have hit songs, you have to have your own songs. So we just felt like it was time.
The songwriting aspect of it for you, I mean, I know you guys are a very collaborative group. How would you guys describe that process for you? It seemed to be a relatively new process considering where you guys came from. How did you find that aspect of the recording process?
Yeah, it was very new for us. I mean, it was certainly an adventure. And every, you know, we wrote with a ton of different songwriters and producers, and some of them went really well, and some of them went really terribly, but it was a really cool way to explore different creative avenues and kind of figure out what our sound was. I feel like we're still kind of figuring it out too, but it was quite a learning experience. And in that time, we wrote, you know, about 40 to 50 songs, and we would either write them on our own or with each other sometimes, but never as a full group, because we're all so vastly different that it really helps to just kind of work in small teams and kind of form the song from there and then bring it to the group.
I find it interesting, you know, the last decade or so, we sort of seen a rebirth or a resurgence of the type of pop music that is popular, you know, from the Lady Gagas to the Katy Perrys, and now yourself with this new style of, I mean, it's not a new style of singing, but a new way of bringing pop music to the foreground. Where do you think, you know, pop music has come in its trajectory in the last 10 years, let's say, from when you maybe were younger and were students?
That's a good question. I feel it's interesting because I feel like a lot more of it is very mass produced, but also it really has become
more emotional over the years. Like with Adele, I mean, she is basically just vocals and piano, and it really kind of tugs at your heartstrings. So I feel like people are just looking for something new that they can actually latch onto that, you know, speaks to their emotions rather than just, you know, a fun pop outfit, which can be great, but I don't know, I think people are just looking for something new.
When you first got together as a group, did you always know that you were going to do the a cappella thing, or did that just organically come out of discussions that arose?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, we formed the group for NBC's The Sing-Off, so we started as a cappella from the beginning. But, you know, after we kind of created this fan base for ourselves, we were like, well, we can't go back now. I mean... what people like what we do because it's a cappella, so you know we're sticking to our brand.
You know, a cappella it can be tough just getting all the harmonies in place. When you're sort of structuring a song like that, how I mean, obviously, you know, you have the bass, you have all your vocal ranges, but how do you go about working out who's going to harmonize what?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. I mean, we have Avi and Kevin as the foundation of the song, the bass and beatbox, and you know, whoever sings the solo in the song, the other two singers will cover all of the harmonies.
So you guys actually got to work with Jason Derulo on this album when you covered "Shy." Talk about working with somebody like him.
Oh my God, it was totally surreal. But he was so cool. He was the most professional, and he was such a perfectionist, which was awesome. Yeah, he was such a sweet guy, and the coolest thing about it is that he was so stoked to work with us when, you know, we were also equally as excited to work with him because he's huge, and he's such a hit maker. But I'm really pleased with the way that one turned out. He sounds amazing on it.
And I know one single that got a lot of traction for you guys off this album was "Can't Sleep Love." What can you tell us about that track?
That track was actually brought to us by this amazing producer-songwriter, and we absolutely fell in love with it. So we took his original and we kind of reworked it, added some more lyrics, and I feel like it's a song that a lot of people can relate to because... you know, people are just looking for that special someone that kind of excites them and sets their heart on fire. But it's a very lighthearted song as well.
And then you also had another great single, the first one I released, I believe, called "Cheerleader." What can you tell us about that track?
That one, well, when Omi first released it, well, actually, when the remix came out, we absolutely fell in love with the song because it was very up our alley, just as musicians, but also we, you know, immediately recognized that it would be an amazing song for Pentatonix to cover. So we did. I feel like it was pretty simple to arrange because we loved it so much.
You know, out of all the songs that are on your album, could you pick a favorite?
You know, I could. I would say New Year's Day is probably my favorite song.
Okay.
Because I was a part of that process from beginning to end, and I just love what it turned out to be, and there's this gorgeous choir in the background. Yeah, it's definitely one of my favorites.
Now, you guys have been fortunate, both in the last couple of years, that you've won a couple of Grammy Awards. I know last year you won for Daft Punk, I believe. And then this year it says you won for Dance at the Sugar Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. For a group of such as yourselves, what is the Grammy experience like?
It honestly was totally surreal because we're so new, and it's just the fact that we even get to be at such a prestigious ceremony, let alone that we've won two awards already. It's unbelievable, and it just, you know, it really kind of validates all the hard work that we've put into this group and our craft. It's amazing.
We briefly mentioned the Sing-Off there. I know you guys won the third season in 2011, and there's been a lot of, you know, since Idol came on, there's been a slew of singing reality shows in that vein. How do you think shows like The Sing-Off or The Voice or Idol or The X Factor or even America's Got Talent, how have they helped maybe artists in today's modern age?
Well, I mean, so many people watch those shows, so it's certainly a ton of exposure. But the tricky thing is that people are so obsessed with that show that once a winner is crowned, then the audience immediately moves on to the next. You know what I mean? So it's a bit challenging in that way, but it's certainly amazing for exposure, and I feel like a lot of success has come to those who have won those.
And I know you guys got a recording contract out of that, and you're still with Sony today. When you guys won and finally dotted the I's and crossed the T's on the recording contract, what was going through your minds?
Honestly, I mean, it was very daunting because we had no experience prior to that, so other than being totally terrified, we were really excited. I mean, we were embarking on a new career path, and I think we were just young and naive, and it wasn't always amazing from the beginning. We certainly had our fair share of rejection and rough spots, but I think we're in a really good place now, especially with the label.
And I gotta ask you about appearing in Pitch Perfect 2. Those movies have a huge fan base. How did that come about, and what was that experience like for you?
Honestly, I think a big part of it had to do with our fans sort of petitioning for us to be in the movie, but we also knew a ton of people that worked on the movie as well, because a lot of them are from the actual acapella world, so they invited us on to be a part of it, and we were so excited. It was such an unbelievable experience. It was very quick, but it was amazing to see kind of what all goes into a huge major motion picture production. And I still can't believe we're in an actual movie.
And you guys got to play a Canadian team.
Yeah.
getting in touch with your inner Canuck. Finally, what can you tell us about On My Way Home? I understand that it's a documentary about you guys.
Yeah. So that's a documentary that basically just follows us around our first couple of tour legs in 2015, and it's sort of an in-depth look at what goes on behind the scenes, and our personalities and how much work we put into it. It's actually really cool. I was really, really proud of the way it turned out.
Well, the new album is Pentatonics. It's the fourth album, the first album of original material. Mitchell Grassi from Pentatonics, thanks so much for joining me today, man.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty, have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Ciao.
That was my chat with Mitch Grassi of the Grammy Award-winning group Pentatonics. And now this is the new single off Pentatonics' album. Here is Sing. Yeah.
it for your mama, ayy. Sing it for your papa, ayy. Sing it for the whole world, whether boy or girl, for your number one, baby. K.O. and the beat, okay? I'm the human baby. Go ahead, go and sing it, die, cause the beat won't stop. No, wait, wait, wait. Sing, 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 sing. Sing it out as hard as you can. Make them hear you from LA to Japan. Don't let them bring you down. This is how we do it now.
Seller is a pinball and classic arcade game collector. He actually owns more than 60 pinball machines, which he puts out at various locations across the Lower Mainland for people to enjoy. His collection is part of a new art exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver called All Together Now, a new art exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver, which explore motivations for collecting through wall-to-wall interactive displays of rare, unconventional, and awe-inspiring objects, including pinball machines, artificial limbs, and public transit ephemera. I spoke with Kyle Seller earlier this summer.
I'm fascinated. You are a pinball and classic arcade game collector, and I know you're going to be appearing in a new exhibit at the Museum of Vancouver. How did you get involved in this exhibit? Did they come to you?
Yeah, they did actually. I've got a vintage arcade in Strathcona, and it's at a skate shop. It's at the Land Yacht Skate Shop, and we popped it in last year, just on kind of a whim, and because they had this extra room in this beautiful building, and I saw it and I was like, that's really cool. And I went to the manager. I didn't even know him. I was like, what do you think about an arcade? He's like, that's cool. And so we just instantly became friends, and we decided to do it. And then, you know, a month later, it came out and people were just crazy about it. And so the museum heard about it as well through Van City Buzz and some other sources. And they fell in love with it, and they like, you know, the story behind it. And so then we started talking, and that's how we came about doing an exhibit in the museum.
What is it for you? Like, what was the sort of the awe and mystique, or what did you like about the arcade collections or the arcade games that made you want to start collecting them?
Well, I grew up with them. I was really big into hanging in arcades after work or after school and sometimes during school. As I grew older, I really missed that component of my life. And so I started buying them when I was like 16 years old. And, something that allures me to them now is just how creative they are, and the artwork is just kind of over the top creative, and it's I treat it as art nowadays, and so I mean that's my appeal to it.
You know, our arcades are definitely still around, but they seem a lot different than they were, you know, back 10, 15, 20 years ago. How do you compare the arcades, you know, now versus the arcades of back then?
Well, yeah, it's totally a dying industry. Well, it's been dead for a long time. The modern arcade is more based on redemption, so it's more for like children. Basically, they play these games and they award them with tickets and then they take those tickets and they buy like teddy bears and candy and things. The skill is kind of limited, and everything's very similar. It's kind of lame in a way. But that being said, on a positive note, I mean, the old school stuff has, you know, made a resurgence. And so there's kind of like this new trend, which is called the barcade. And that's kind of really, really taking off in West Coast cities around Canada and US. And, you know, where you'll see a bar with like, you know, 10, 20, 30 machines. And so you can eat and drink and hang out. And so that's an exciting part of the new style arcade.
And I know one of the big things in your collection is pinball. I think I read you have over 60 different pinballs. And to me, I don't think anything epitomizes like the classic arcade more than pinball. Why do you think that game has survived for so long?
I think it survived for so long because, you know, there's never a same experience twice. Never. So, you know, a majority of your console games and a lot of video games, they're all like pattern based. So once you master the pattern, then, you know, it's kind of like it gets old and repetitive, whereas pinball, like the physics and the ball and the movement and everything, it's always different. So, I mean, you can technically never master a pinball machine. It's impossible. And so you're always striving to do better. But there's so many variables involved. And I think that always keeps like you playing, and it keeps it fresh.
And one of the things I've enjoyed about pinball over the years is sort of all the different themes that come out. Like there's like Game of Thrones now and Lord of the Rings. What do you make of the fact that pinball has become like this own market unto itself? Like it's now become a marketing tool almost.
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. I've grew up with the evolution of pinball, and I almost consider it now like almost mainstream. It's so strange. It's like everyone seems to know about it. And so, yeah, you're getting all these companies and startups now that are starting to churn out machines. And, you know, Stern is, I guess, the largest company, and it's been around for a long time. And they're like producing like 4 games a year, which is a lot. But then you've got like Jersey Jack Pinball, which just created The Wizard of Oz, and they just released their latest, which is The Hobbit. And you've got all these little homebrew startups, and I would assume it's pretty tough business. But, you know, it's cool to see everything that's going on, and there's lots of innovation going on with pinball right now at a very, very advanced. So it's pretty cool.
It's strange because I feel like the last, you know, five or 10 years, in a way, you know, things that are retro are making a bit of a comeback. Not that they ever went away, but you know, they're more, I think more young people are discovering them. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I definitely see, you know, the retro thing making a comeback, but I also kind of equate it to, I feel like, you know, console gaming took away the pinball and video game industry, like on location. And so everyone kind of back in like 85 or 82 even, you know, started, the home consoles came out. People started like, you know, staying at home and like playing the games. And that's been going on for, you know, 30 years. But now I feel like most of the console games, they kind of plateaued. And so it's like the FIFA that came out this year is not much different than the FIFA that came out 4 or 5 years ago. So I feel like people are kind of looking for new avenues to game, and they're kind of getting tired of being at home. And so they're looking for more of a social environment with gaming that is not at home or not on a headset. So I think that's part of the retro comeback too. And it's just more of people want to get out and socialize and play. And it's a neat thing.
So back to the exhibit at the museum a little bit. What sort of stuff are you going to be showcasing during it?
I've got a very different mix of stuff. It's mainly based on my personal preference. A lot of the stuff that I've been collecting and some of my favorites that I've had for 20 years. And all the way to some modern stuff, but it's basically the stuff that really, I grew up with and I loved, and I love the artwork and the style and the themes. And I've got a few vintage pieces there as well. I've got some games that I've restored and some games that I won at tournaments for competing. So it's an eclectic mix, and I've got some arcade games as well, but the majority is pinball. So I'll save the names until the museum opens, but I think people are going to be pretty stoked.
It's funny, just when you were talking about the consoles, and I know so many classic games started out on the arcade and then transferred over to console. How do you think the when they went to console, how did that change maybe the playing of the game or the player's perspective of the game, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I wonder. I think that the way it changed, well, it took out the social aspect a lot of the time, because you wouldn't be, so a lot of the bragging rights might be gone because you're not at the arcade and you're not hanging out with your pals and people aren't watching over you. And it also kind of made stuff a little bit more repetitive because you can play it as much as you want. So because it's free once you buy it. I don't really know how to answer that, actually, apart from what I've gave you there.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's a tough question.
So, what would you say, besides pinball, what would you say were some of your favorite arcade games growing up?
Well, so you're talking stand-up or like arcade and pinball or...
Yeah, like I know for me, whenever I went into arcade, if I saw a version of Tekken, I would have to play it, because I just loved, Tekken and a lot of those early type of fighter games that you saw in the arcade.
Yeah, I think my favorite is I've got a few, but one of my favorites is Wonder Boy in Monster Land. And it was like this side adventure game platformer. And the great thing about it was like that it was a game that you could master on one quarter. But it took a really long time to get good at it and to figure it out. And if you could do it on one quarter, you have 45 minutes of play time. So it was like, and the game was just amazing. So I would say that's my favorite. Another one that was really good was Black Tiger. And it was a similar platformer that, again, it was extremely hard, but you could fight your way to the end on one quarter. And you get like 45 minutes out of it. And it would be like the raddest thing to do on the way home before dinner. And I would say those are my two favorite games. You didn't see them a lot in the arcades, but a lot of people know of them.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
I think there's definitely a misconception about video games. I think mainly that, you know, they're not art or they're not entertainment or they're not educational. I take it you obviously don't feel that way, but how do you think that video games fit into that sort of area?
I think they're intensely artistic. Like one of the most commercially artistic things that are out. Even console games, for that matter. They're based on art, and you know, from like concept drawings to what they put in the game, and music is all original. So it's like all these different things that are all components in art in the real world. Like music is an art, and obviously like drawing and those types of things are art as well. So, you know, when it gets transferred all into the video game, you know, I do think that's definitely an art form, especially the old stuff, like the old stuff from the 80s, even up to the 90s and stuff. I feel like the artists had like free rein to do whatever the heck they wanted to build something. So like someone would give them a concept and say, hey, we're going to make a game about roller coasters. And then they would just go nuts. And it was this free rein of what they liked. And it was a really interesting time for the industry at that time. Nowadays, it's not so much. Like a lot of the games now that come out, they're theme based, and they have boundaries put on by, you know, the themes that they're developing for. So companies need to review their art and their packages, and they need to use, you know, various components from, example, a movie if they're making a movie based game. So it's not saying now, but I'd say it's an art form. As far as educational, that's tough. I don't play games for educational purposes myself, but I know there are some.
Well, the collection is going to appear in All Together Now, Vancouver Collectors and Their Worlds, and the exhibit opens on the 23rd of June and runs through January 8th at the Museum of Vancouver. Kyle, just before I go, where can people go to find one of your arcade games, other than the museum?
Right. I have a pinball arcade in at Pub 340, which is on 340 Canby Street in East Vancouver, and I've got a pinball room there with 11 machines that are, you know, really nicely maintained. So that's a really cool place for people to go. It's 19 and over. And then I would say for like a more old school experience for arcade and pinball machines, that they would go to the Land Yachts skate shop in Strathcona, and that's at 1146 Union Street. And I've got about 23 machines there. So it's really cool.
All right. Well, Vancouver Collectors and Their Worlds, everyone should check it out. Kyle Seller, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, no problem. It's great to speak to you.
Alrighty, ciao.
All right, cheers.
That was my chat with pinball and arcade game collector Kyle Seller. We're going to take you out with one final song from Pentatonix. This is Na 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 off their self-titled new album. I just want to say thank you to everybody for their patience over this past summer. It was definitely longer than I anticipated, but it feels really, really good to be back. So I just want to say, hola mis chicos, yo voy regresar a Galapagos. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I'll see you soon. Ciao for now.
Woke up whistling like the wind blows, looking out my window just to see the shine.
Oh, 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 hey.
Baby, you might call it crazy how I'm acting lately, skipping through the sky.
Oh, 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 hey.
I see so clearly why I'm on. well to the other side. Let's go tiptoe on a tightrope. Falling's only natural. Just spread your wings and fly. You'll see so clearly why I'm always feeling free.
Yeah.